Welcome. Your Sanskrit is getting very good. Very good. Always pleased to hear Sanskrit chanted so beautifully. Thank you for that. It's music and poetry to my ear. Today we're going to pay tribute and talk about and learn about Ram, Lord Ram, or sometimes called Ramachandra, because Ram's appearance day is coming up on Sunday. Ram Navami. Navami means ninth, so it's the ninth day of the moon, waxing moon. And the Indians call it Ram Nomi, which is the shortened form of Navami. Ram Nomi, it's very popular in India. So we're going to tell a little bit about Ram's story. You've heard of Sita and Ram, Sita Ram. That's his wife, Sita. Sita is an incarnation of the goddess of fortune, Lakshmi, as is Radha, or vice versa. And Ram is an incarnation of Vishnu. Vishnu is God. Today is a silver day on your monthly planners. For those of you that got the monthly planner, Moon is exalted. Shifted over this afternoon, so. Antonio just sent us a 2-page email raving about his monthly planner and how well it's working. Kalindi, why don't you tell us about the monthly planner? For those of you who don't know about the monthly planner, this is an astrological thing that I've put together based on, of course, Vedic astrological calculation. And we call it the Strategic Monthly Business Planner. Did you get one? Well, you'll have to get one. And I call it business for business people because I'm kind of aiming it at that, but it's for everybody, and it's not only about business. It's about whatever you want to do, and you want it to go well, which is all kinds of things. And I've called the days gold days, silver days, bronze days, and gray days. Bronze days, well, it's simple. Everybody knows gold, silver, bronze. Everybody knows that. Gray, everybody knows that. See, I don't even have to tell you what it means. So gold are very, very favorable days, highly favorable days. And silver are the next best thing, also very favorable, quite favorable. That's what we have today, right now, as of 16:44 p.m. Bronze is your average day. Just, you know, go and do stuff. But when you have really important things to do that are really meaningful for you and they must succeed, they must go well, you want to pick silver or gold days, naturally. Bronze days, okay. Gray days, not good. Very problematic, troublesome. Anybody got any stories? Kalindi has a really great story. Please tell us.
Last weekend, I wanted to start making the veggie rice. So I went off to Woody a half an hour before the changeover into the grated.
She said to me, I got to go buy this stuff. I said, you better hurry because you've got to get there and buy it within a half an hour and then it's going to flip over. And if you buy things in a gray day, you could oftentimes buy things that will become very problematic for you. Not work, break down, that sort of thing. So I said, you better hurry.
I went down to Woody's. I found huge, big, long wooden joists, piled them up. I had like 15 of them. And negotiated in the shop with these huge, big things on a trolley. And also I had a bunch of manure and a bunch of plants. And I didn't have my watch on. So I got up to the counter a little after it just changed over. And all of their tills went down and all their credit card machines went down. And I only had my laser card. So I just had to leave everything
there. You had to leave everything behind. You couldn't buy anything because you could only buy with cash. So, I mean, just like almost...
Yeah, exactly as it was. They just said our sales just went down.
Just right on the time that it flipped over to the grade A.
People had to leave the shop.
So...
That was my
See, you don't do things in a grade.
We just clarified that your birth, that's coming from your own personal birth.
No. This is just general.
Okay.
This is as general can be, but it is effectively the influence of the planets. Now, it is calculated for this time zone. So the ones I've done for California, for example, the west coast of the U.S., I've done a few people there. Those have to be done for that time zone. So it's whatever time zone you're in. So, for example, if you wanted to use it, the one you have, and you're in France, you have to add an hour. That's it, simply, you know. Okay. If you're in New York, you have to subtract 5 hours. Okay. There was a sage... the book known as the Ramayana, The Life of Ram, was written by a sage named Valmiki. And Valmiki was born in a Brahmin family, that is, a family of priests, saintly persons, dedicated to cultivating knowledge, worshipping God, doing various penances, vows, you know. That kind of stuff. Studying the Vedas. And I can't remember why he... Anyway, he fell out of his practice and became a hunter. And he had amassed a very large family. He was having a lot of babies with his... wife. He had a lot of mouths to feed, so he couldn't feed them all as a hunter. So then he became a thief and a miscreant and a dacoit and a gurrier, which is a dacoit. And he then began to steal from people. And so he went from a very high level of consciousness down to a very low level of consciousness. And he lost his spiritual consciousness. Is this possible? Can this happen to people? Oh, yeah. It can. So one day, Narada Muni means sage. And Narada, we've spoken about him, is a sage that plays a veena. This is not a veena. This is a tambura. But he's a sage that plays a veena like a sitar. Musical guy, very elevated soul, can go anywhere in the universe. He arrives and he says, why don't you turn your life around? And this guy, Mika was saying how much he was suffering when his life, and Narada says, you can turn your life around. Just chant the names of God. Why don't you just chant Rama? Two syllables, Rama. And as you will see, that Rama means, you know, it means spiritual happiness, spiritual revelation. It means pleasing, delightful, beautiful, lovely, charming. It's all these wonderful meanings. And of course, Valmiki, his heart was very corrupt. He says, no, I'm not going to chant that. He said, I just as soon chant death. Over and over. Death. Mara. In Sanskrit, death is Mara. Mara. So, Narada said, that's a very good idea. Why don't you just chant death over and over again? And I want you to chant it from morning till night, and I'll be back in a month to see how you're doing. I'm now your guru. I will initiate you into this chanting of Mara, death, and then I'll come back to check on you. So Narada went away, came back in 30 days, and there's Valmiki. I mean, he's got his Japamala, and he's chanting Mara. Mara, 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 Mara. So Mara, when you say it over and over, beside it becomes Mara, 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 Mara. So he chanted Rama. But he thought he was chanting Mara. And Narada came back and said, there's this light around Valmiki. He's chanting away. He's happy. His darkness is leaving. And
no sign of death.
Not much sign of death around there. And he says, so how's it going? Good. Really good. I really enjoy chanting this death over and over. Narada says, well, you're not actually chanting death. You're chanting the name Ram, Rama. And that's why you're undergoing this transformation. And then it clicked in for Valmiki. And he realized that Narada had tricked him in a very positive way. And he surrendered to Narada. And he turned his life around from that point forward. And he raised himself back up to his Brahman existence. Purified himself by chanting Rama, Rama. And at some point in the future, because he, let's see, who told him the story? Narada or Vyas told him the story of Ram, which I'm going to tell you in a moment. And back in those days, everything was oral tradition. Yeah? Nobody wrote anything down. I've told you this. There's no need. Why? Because everybody remembered immediately. They'd hear. So they grasp, retain. Nowadays we call it photographic memory. Back then they called it typical, usual, expected. Like everybody can do it. So he heard the story of Ram, he retained it, and then Brahma, the creator, who creates the material manifestation we've talked about, said, Valmiki, you seem to be so taken with this story of Ram, and in fact that was the mantra that ended up purifying you. Why don't you write the story in Sanskrit poetry? And why not make that the culmination of your life, your life's work? And Valmiki said, yes, I will do it. Praying to Ram, bowing to Ram, surrendering myself, I will ask for the inspiration, the guidance, and the creativity to write this epic poem. 24,000 verses. Sanskrit poetry. Poetry's hard. Sanskrit poetry, it's a whole other level, ladies and gentlemen. It's a whole other level. So, he's the author of the Ramayana. He's not the only... There's other stories of Ram. Ram's life is told. There's a couple others. You know, one guy's... I think his name is Kamban. Another guy's Tulsidas, who've also written their version. Now... So that's Valmiki. Good story, huh? We are now in Treta Yuga. Treta Yuga is Silver Age. Gold, silver, now forget the days, we're back to the Yugas. The universe has four seasons. They repeat, like our seasons repeat. Golden Age, Silver Age, Bronze Age, Iron Age. Satya is gold, Treta is silver, Dwapara is bronze, and Kali, the one we're in now, Iron Age. Right? This is the Silver Age, Treta Yuga. In Treta Yuga, Treta Yuga lasts 1,296,000 years. Human years. And people in that age live 10,000 years duration. In this age, they live 100 years. They live 10,000 in that one. Okay? And that's when Ram appeared. So, Ram appeared in Silver Age. The next day, right at the very end of the Dwapara Yuga, the Bronze Age, Krishna appeared. But right at the very end, that age lasted for 864,000 years. Now, we are in the Iron Age. Okay, and we talked about Chaitanya a couple of weeks ago. Okay. The reason for Ram's birth, when Ravana, who was a big demon, was ruling over Lanka, Sri Lanka, Ceylon, as a terror to the world, evils and cruelties like matricide, patricide, fratricide, infanticide, killing of cows, hatred for good people, death of children, abduction of women, killing of sages, theft became rampant. Because he was this powerful demon that received a boon or a benediction, I think it was from Brahma. So let me continue here. Okay. When the world became grief-stricken, Bhumi Devi, Bhumi is goddess of the earth, who, when she appears, will oftentimes take the form of a cow. Because the earth is a mother symbol, the cow is a mother symbol. And assumed the form of a cow and took refuge with Indra. Indra is chief of the gods, the demigods, in the heavenly planetary system. She told him about the atrocities committed by Ravana and his demon friends, the Rakshasas. Then Indra took Bhumi, the earth, to Brahma, the creator, and they went to Shiva at Kailas. Anyway, they all got together. They had a convocation. And they all decided to pray to Vishnu and help to relieve this distress. So Vishnu said, I have decided to incarnate myself as the son of King Dasharath in Ayodhya. You devas should also take birth on earth to help me kill Ravana and other negative forces. So as we said many times, when the world, the earth becomes overburdened by too much negative, hurtful, destructive, or demoniac energies, sometimes God will appear, God will take an incarnation called an avatar. Avatar means to come down, to descend, and do two things essentially. Wipe out the destructive people and protect the faithful, the good people, the virtuous people, the righteous people, devotees, those who love God. That's generally what the purpose is. Okay? But he doesn't come alone. He gets the demigods, if you like, angels or archangels, to also incarnate into human form to help him in his mission. Because that's who he likes to hang out with. He doesn't as much like to hang out with us humans as he does the higher beings. Which should be no surprise to anybody. No offense intended. But if you were him, you'd feel the same way. So that's why Vishnu agreed to come down. Now, Ayodhya is the name of the city in the kingdom of Kosala, where Dasharath was the king. And Dasharath was a very good king, very learned. He was a Raja Rishi, king sage. Raja Rishi, king sage. So he was a warrior, he protected the people, but he was also a very wise man, very learned. And the kingdom thrived. There was prosperity everywhere. The rains came at the right time. As he used to sing in that Camelot song. Of course, it only rained at night. And even the Vedas even says that. It would only rain at night and not in the day. Well, sometimes. I don't know about all the time. But anyway, there's abundance. There's no poverty. There'd be no lack. There's no drought. This kind of thing. Everything's beautiful and everybody is happy. The king's job is to make sure that every single citizen, people and animals, their citizens too, are all happy and cared for. And if the citizens are not happy and cared for, he cannot do what? Levy tax. He's entitled to, tell that to the Revenue Commission. See what they say. His job is to protect everybody. And if he doesn't do it, he's really not supposed to take tax. Okay? Now, I'll read a bit of this now. To the north of the Ganga, of the Ganges River, was the great kingdom of Kosala, made fertile by the river Sarayu. Its capital was Ayodhya, built by Manu, the famous ruler of the Solar Dynasty. From Valmiki's description of the capital of Kosala, it is clear that the ancient Ayodhya was not inferior to our modern cities. Even in ancient India, city civilizations had reached a high level. King Dasharatha ruled the kingdom from the capital city of Ayodhya. He had fought on the side of the gods, and his fame spread in the three worlds. Heavenly worlds, earthly worlds, hellish worlds. He was the equal of Indra and Kuvera. Kuvera is the Lord of Wealth. The people of Kosala were happy, contented, and virtuous. The land was protected by a mighty army, and no enemy could come anywhere near. So they were also safe. It contained forts with moats around them, as well as many defensive installations. And true to its name, Ayodhya defied all enemies. Ayodhya means can't be beaten, can't be defeated. Yodhya means defeated, and ah means not, Ayodhya. Dasharatha had 8 wise ministers ever ready to advise him and execute his orders. Great sages like Vasishta and Vamadev and other Brahmins, priests, taught the Dharma and performed rituals and sacrifices of various kinds. Taxes were light, and punishment of crime was just and inflicted according to the capacity of the wrongdoer. Surrounded by the best counselors and statesmen, the king's splendor shone like the rising sun. Many years rolled by smoothly. In the midst of all this prosperity, Dasharatha had one regret. He had no son. He had no heir. And no daughters either. But the king wants a male heir, as they tend to do in any tradition that you read about. One day in early summer, he thought of performing a special sacrifice to beget children, progeny. He consulted his religious advisors, and on their advice, got the sage Rishya Shringa to perform the yagya. Yagya is sacrifice. And the yagya they would have would be building a pit and putting sand in or earth and then having a fire in this pit. The sacred fire consecrated by mantras. They pour ghee in the fire. They offer mantras. So that's the kind of sacrifice they would have. And all the king would give away a lot of charity. I mean, like thousands of cows, a thousand cows, because it's a source of food, right? Land, cows, clothing, food, gems, all nice things. That's what they would typically do. So the yagya was a grand affair, and the invitees included many kings of the day. It was no easy thing to perform a yagya. The location and the erection of the sacrificial platform had to be attended to in detail, strictly according to prescribed rules. There were experts whose guidance was sought in arranging things. It meant the building of a new tent city capable of accommodating temporary city, in other words, capable of accommodating tens of thousands and providing hospitality and entertainment for the invitees, who included princes and sages of the land. In short, the yagya in those days were something like our present-day state-sponsored exhibitions and fairs and these kinds of things. When all the arrangements were complete, the ceremonies were set into motion. It's going to take too long to read all that. So what happened was the fire god himself appeared out of the fire, and he carried a pot of nectar, or sweet rice. And Dasharatha had three wives, Kaushalya and Sumitra and Kaikeyi. Kaushalya was the oldest and senior wife. She was told to eat half of the sweet rice. The other half was divided between the other two wives, Kaikeyi and Sumitra. So Kaikeyi ate a quarter, and Sumitra ate her quarter on two occasions. So she ate an eighth and then an eighth, correct? So Kaushalya, the oldest wife, gave birth to Ram, who's Vishnu incarnate. Some places say he was 75% Vishnu. Some places say he was 50% Vishnu. But he's God energy. All right? Kaikeyi gave birth to Bharat, and the brother of Ram. And Sumitra gave birth to twins. The ones she ate, the two eighths. She gave birth to twins. Lakshman and Shatrughna. Four boys. So they grew up strong and virtuous, but no one, Ram was the main guy. He was the main son. And everybody loved him. Everybody. Now, why would they? Ta-da! And we have his chart. We have his birth chart. Now, we know that exalted planets are very favorable and can really bring special souls into the world. Most humans don't have exalted planets. If you got one, you're doing pretty good. If you've got two, really good. If you got three, Really good. Really good. So Ram has how many?
Four.
No, it's not that many planets. Five. Five exalted planets. There's nine planets altogether. So he's got five exalted. And then he's got Moon and Rahu and Ketu, three in their own sign. Five exalted, three in their own sign, and one regular, so to speak. So that is one way to determine the level of energy and power of a soul. I mean, it works. So, for your interest, Ram has a Cancer ascendant with Jupiter exalted on the ascendant, with Moon and Cancer. One of the nicest conjunctions of planets is Moon and Jupiter together. It's wonderful. When in the monthly planner, when Moon and Jupiter are together, that is a gold day. That's what creates a gold day. And he's got an exalted Mars. So he was a great warrior and a great king. And he has exalted Venus. He married the goddess of fortune herself, Sita. Not bad. Not bad. Of course, we all know that the goddess of fortune is fickle. And the only one she ever hangs around with permanently is God himself. She may come to your house for a while. She may come to your house for an entire lifetime, for a few lifetimes, and then she'll say, okay, gotta go now. Bye. Yeah, and if you're at all interested in this piece of information, there's Lakshmi that we received as a gift from Kalindi's parents, the one on the right. And when you have Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune, in a statue form like that, any kind of image, by herself, not so much with Vishnu. On the left is Lakshmi and Vishnu together. So they're standing. But when you have Lakshmi by herself, she must be sitting. Because if she's not sitting, she's going to trot on out of the house. That's what the Indians say. No, if you show an Indian, you had a Lakshmi there standing up, they go, good. That is not so good. But it's okay if she's standing up beside Vishnu, but... I know a person who has a beautiful bronze Lakshmi, how tall? 4 feet, four or five feet tall, gorgeous standing Lakshmi. And this person was pulling in at one time a million a month, $1 million a month. And sometimes more. And that person subsequently has gone bankrupt. Now, I'm not saying it's about his Lakshmi standing up, because there's karma involved in that, but interestingly. All right. Ram has his Venus with Ketu in this chart. Venus and Ketu together here. Venus is his wife. Venus is exalted. But it's with Ketu, which means separation. So there was a separation. So what happened? Ram and the brothers grew up, they're Kshatriyas, meaning they're growing up as warriors. They're being trained as Kshatriyas. They're also being trained spiritually because the consciousness and spirituality was also very high and important. And they were surrounded by very powerful sages who could do things that most humans don't even dream of being able to do. And these were incarnations of God, after all. So even as young boys, they helped the sages kill off some of the demons that were ruining sacrifices and spiritual practices and performances in the ashrams, in the forests, in the hermitages, in the forests nearby. Then Ram was very popular, very, very popular, and very well loved. by everybody. And that's his Jupiter, or Moon in Cancer, Jupiter in Cancer on the ascendant. So he's all heart. I mean, literally all heart. You know.
Do you have any jealousies around that with his brothers?
That's an excellent question. Excellent question. Not with his brothers, but because they all loved him the same. But what happened was, Dasharatha decided when Ram was... Well, I'm jumping ahead a bit. There was a Swayamvara, and that is when a king wants to marry off his daughter. And he sends word out far and wide, my daughter is, it's marriageable age, and I want to find a suitor for her. So the kings and princes from far and wide can come. But they had this huge bow, like a bow and arrow, that kind of a bow, shooting bow, archer, bow, archery bow. It was huge, and it had belonged to Shiva. And you know who Shiva is. You got it. Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. Yeah. And it was sitting there on a stand, and it needed to be strung. There was the bowstring. And the contest was whoever could string Shiva's bow would get Sita's hand in marriage. Sita was the name of the princess, and her father's name was King Janaka. And I can't remember the whole story, but King Janaka somehow, he came down, his dynasty came down from Mother Earth, Bhumi. So he would pray to Bhumi for different things. And one day he was symbolically plowing. I mean, he wouldn't do the plowing in his kingdom. He was symbolically plowing the field for the beginning of the season. And they turned over the furrows in the plow, and Sita appeared. She was sitting. A little baby was in the furrows. She was born from the furrow. Sita means furrow of the field. That's how she was born. And she was part of God's fortune. So she was, of course, exceedingly beautiful, needless to say. And all these kings came, and no one could even bend the bow, let alone string it. And of course, Ram bent the bow and strung the bow. And then as he pulled the bow back, pulled the bowstring back, snapped the bow in two. So he was considered to be the guy. And he got Sita's hand in marriage. And Sita had some other sisters. The four brothers got four wives out of the whole deal together. The four sisters married the four brothers.
Seven brothers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Four brides for four brothers. So that's what happened. Then, so everything was going on very nicely. They were back at in Ayodhya in Dasharatha's kingdom. And it was pretty much understood that Ram was, he was the oldest son, and he was going to, he was the heir apparent, and he would assume the throne. So Dasharatha said, well, you know, I've had a good life. I'm going to now turn my throne over to my son. At that time, his brother Bharat, now trying to focus on the names, I'll try and make it easy for you. His brother Bharat, who was the son of the queen Kaikeyi, had gone to Kaikeyi's father's kingdom. In other words, he'd gone to his grandfather's kingdom to spend a little bit of time with his grandfather. So he wasn't there. And, you know, they would travel on foot with an entourage, so it would take a long time to go there. And then in those days, you didn't rush back. You stayed for a few months. And when you said you're ready to leave, oh, no, 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 you can't go. You just got here. Please, just promise us 2 more months, and then you go. It's not like like another few more minutes or a couple more hours. No, it was like months. And you read that regularly, and plus they lived for 10,000 years, so I mean, what's a few months here and there? So, you know, he was there for some time. And for some reason, I don't know why, probably to further the story, Dasharatha said to his priest, the main sage, Vasishtha, who is very, very powerful, very elevated sage, he said, I want to turn the throne over to Ram. I want to crown Ram king. And Vasishtha said, and he took it over. He consulted his court, his advisors. Everybody said, yes, this is a great idea. Please, let's do it. And Vasishtha said, well, we can do it even tomorrow, because tomorrow is a very favorable day. It probably was. I don't know. I think they tell you what the constellation was. It's like Uttara Falguni, I think. So it would have been ruled by the sun. Yeah. But that's the part that I have a hard time sort of grasping is, what, the next day? You know, it seems a little, I mean, it's a big thing that you have to. Anyway, to further the storyline. And plus, Bharata wasn't there. He was away. The brother was away at his grandfather's place. So, everybody was, the whole place was abuzz with the good news that Ram was going to be king. And then, in the queen's private apartments, Kaikeyi, who was the mother of Bharat, she had a hunchback servant, this old lady whose name was Mantara, who was there from her birth and looked after her, you know, the whole time, was always with her. It's her personal servant. And she was a hunchback type. And Mantara means stirrer. That's what it means in Sanskrit, stirrer. So Mantara says, Kaikeyi, there you sit. You know, your whole world is crashing down around you, and there you sit, as if everything's fine. Well, what do you mean? They're about to crown Ram king, and your bard is going to probably be exiled, and he's going to get the short end of the stick here, and you do nothing. Okay, he's talking about, everybody loves Ram. I love Ram. You know, he's my son, like my son. You know, he's my stepson or half son. And what's the problem? So Mantara kept working on her, and filling her heart with jealousy, and saying all the worst things are going to happen once Ram gets the kingdom. You two will be exiled here or there. And finally, she had Kaikeyi absolutely distraught, beside herself. Well, what should I do? I mean, there's nothing I can do. Don't you remember? Mantara said. Many years ago, when your husband, Dasharatha, was fighting in this battle, and he was knocked unconscious, you ran onto the battlefield and jumped onto his chariot and drove his chariot off the battlefield with him laying on the floor of the chariot, and you saved his life. Do you remember that? No woman was on the battlefield, but you were, because you had so much courage and because you loved your husband so much. She said, yeah, I remember it. And she said, she's a warrior woman. So, and what did he say to you at that time? When he regained consciousness, what did he say to you? He said, you saved my life. I want to give you two boons, two favors. Whatever you want, ask of me, I'll give you two favors, whatever you like. And what did you say to him, Kaikeyi? Well, I told him, this is nothing I wanted right now. He says, well, then you can ask later in the future when there's something you want, and I will grant you these favors. And of course, Dasharatha was a man of his word. See, when we do things nowadays in Kali Yuga, in the Iron Age, we say something, and then we retract it and we go, yeah, but it's, you know, it's this and that and this happened, and we really don't think much of it. But back in those days, you don't retract your word. Your word's your bond. Nowadays, it's less, you know, politicians are telling us all kinds of things all the time, you know. So, what you ask for now when you see Dasharat is you want Bharat to be crowned the king. And not wrong. Yeah, but I don't really want... Yes, you do want that. Okay. And, well, you got to read it. You know, I'm giving you the short version. And to make sure that no one interferes with this, you have Ram exiled to the forest for 14 years. And that's what happened. So when Dasharat came to greet Kaikeyi, he said, well, good news, Ram will be crowned tomorrow. She threw a fit, started tearing off her jewelry, throwing it around, and rolling on the floor in distress. Says, I want my boon that you promised me. He says, yes, whatever you like, I'll give you. I want my son Bharat crowned king. And I want Dasharat exiled to the forest. Ram exiled to the forest for 14 years. So Dasharat was beside himself with sorrow, incredulity. He couldn't believe it. But he couldn't go back on his word, because that's what he had promised. So Dasharat called Ram and said, this is what's happening. And Ram said, yes, father, I will go tomorrow. No problem. Because he obeyed everything his father said. That was his nature. And everybody was beside themselves. But you can revoke it. You can do this. Because it's got to be another. Ram says, no. If my father wants me to do that, then I will do it. And this is the hand of fate, obviously, playing into all this. So when Lakshman, who was very close to Ram, his other brother, from Sumitra, the mother Sumitra, he wouldn't let Ram go without him, because they were very close. And then Sita found out. Sita says, no, I'm not letting you go. But Sita, you're used to living, you lived your whole life in a palace, you've got all these beautiful finery, you've got all these servants, and you're not used to difficult life, walking on thorns through the forest and they wore bark for clothes. She says, you're not going to be able to handle this. She says, I don't care, I'm coming with you. She did. So the three of them went off, to make the long story short. And while in the forest, they were there for 13 years, pretty much, you know, it went without too many problems. They killed off a few demons while they were there and had a few interesting adventures. Naturally, they had to kill some demons. And then they were on their last year, final year. And some of the ogres, as I like to call them, ogres, or these really dark characters, found out that this beautiful, beautiful woman was living in the forest in an ashram, and who found out ultimately was Ravana. Ravana was the big demon that Vishnu had come down for, who lived in Sri Lanka. So his sister, who was an ogress, said, you know, you're supposed to be the most powerful man in all three worlds, and this guy, this Ram guy, living in the middle of the forest with not a penny to his name, he's got the most beautiful woman, not you. What are you thinking? So Ravan kidnaps Sita while Ram is away from the hermitage, and takes her someplace, and no one knows where she was taken. Of course, everybody's brokenhearted. He's beside himself. And no one knows where she went. Only then Hanuman comes into the story. That's Hanuman. Hanuman was part of the monkey army. And Hanuman was the son of Vayu, the wind god, and the mother who took the monkey form, Anjana. And Hanuman liked to leap through the air for a few miles. He can do all these supernatural things. So Hanuman, I think some of you have probably heard about Hanuman. Just like Ganesh, he's very, very well known and quite popular. So Hanuman joined Ram's army. He had to get all the monkeys to help him because he had no one else. He was in the forest, him and Lakshmi. And then they had to find out where Sita was being held. Hanuman leapt himself from India over to Sri Lanka. And he found where Sita was being held. He didn't rescue her because that was Ram's job. Couldn't steal Ram's thunder. So what he did was he came back and he reported everything and how many soldiers they had and what their weaponry was and how the city was laid out and all this intelligence. And then he went with all the monkey army. These are monkeys, of course, that could walk and talk and do everything else. Not like the monkeys you think about. These are Treta Yuga monkeys, Silver Age monkeys. Big ones. Bigfoot. And there was no way to get the army from the south part of India over to Sri Lanka. Hanuman could jump, or no one else could. So they got huge boulders and they wrote Ram on the boulders in Sanskrit, Ram, and threw them into the water and they floated. And they built a bridge from south of India all the way to Sri Lanka. And this is a satellite photograph of that area of the world, and the bridge is there. You can see the bridge. You can see it on atlases. They call it Adam's Bridge. But it's only, if you're there, I was there. The place is called Rameshwaram in India, which means Lord Ram. Rama Ishwaram. And if you look across the ocean to Sri Lanka, you don't see anything above the water. All you see is water. So with the satellite photograph, you could see underneath what was underneath, and that's the bridge. You can pass that around. You see it online. It's clearer than I printed it out for you. You can see. So that exists. It's there. Now they call it Adam's Bridge. Yeah, whoever Adam is. You know, I was going to call it after somebody from the West. You know, that's Adam's Bridge. So then they went over with the army. And the army defeated the demons, even though Raman was indestructible. And Ram ultimately, of course, in the climax of the battle, fought Ravan face to face, and he defeated him, naturally. And then Ram returned to to Ayodhya with his brother Lakshman and his wife Sita, and assumed the throne. His brother Bharat whom they tried to take the throne for, didn't want the throne, got very angry at his mother for having manipulated all that, and would not sit on the throne. So what they did was they took Ram's shoes, his sandals, and they set his sandals on the throne. And that's what remained on the throne for 14 years until he returned. And then when he returned and began to govern as the king, he was very just and kind. The main thing about Ram, he's got all these just absolutely wonderful, wonderful qualities of kindness and compassion and justice and mercy, and but also courage and bravery. And he's also exalted Mars, good fighter, hard guy to beat. So there's a lot more to it than that, but that's the essence of the story. When the Ram story, what you just heard, and all the pastimes within that, which we didn't discuss, there's so many things that happen. Is vibrant, existent, and there's all kinds of evidence of it yet on the planet today. When you travel in Bali, Indonesia, Cambodia, Vietnam, Laos, India, Pakistan, Nepal, China, Japan, you will find Ram's story everywhere. All the old, when you see art, when you see the temples, the carvings, the different art forms, it's always the story of Ram. It's everywhere. Still. So that's the impact that it had on the planet. And this was thousands of years ago. Thousands of years ago. So if Ram appeared in the Silver Age, right? Now, I don't know which part of the Silver Age. It's 1,296,000 years long. So I don't know exactly where. Then the next age, the Bronze Age, was 864,000 years long. And now we've done 5,000 years in the Iron Age. So it's got to be, you know, several thousand years since his appearance. And it's still, all the signs of it are still extant. They still exist. So that's the story of Ram. Sunday is Ram's appearance day. Were you guys? Jeez. If anybody would like to, Kalindi and I will be spending the day in fasting and meditation and that sort of stuff. And then we thought perhaps we'd invite you if you want to, and those who want to come, and we'll have a feast, a vegetarian feast on Sunday around 6, let's say. So anybody's interested, let us know ahead of time so we know how much to cook. But it will be this Sunday. All right. Now, Ram, mantra. Ram is one of the 10 major avatars or incarnations of Vishnu. He was a warrior prince who walked the earth in Treta Yuga, the Silver Age of the universe. The purpose of his incarnation was to protect the virtuous and annihilate the nefarious Ravana, a powerful demon whom even the gods could not defeat. Ram represents spiritual bliss. The word Ram represents spiritual bliss or unadulterated happiness. When used as an adjective, it means pleasing, delightful, beautiful, lovely, and charming. And this is exactly how Ram was perceived by all when he appeared on earth thousands of years ago. Ram is considered by some to be the most potent and valuable name of God that one can chant. In the Narda Pancharatra, it says that they asked Narda, if you could chant only one name of God, which one would it be? What's the best one? He says Rama. Chanting the name Rama will remove negative karma and purify a soul quickly and effectively. So, of course, we find Rama in the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. It's one of the main words indicating the male energy, divine energy. Or if you want, you could chant Rama, Rama, Rama. So I've given you one here. This is actually a little bhajan chant that's you'll find it's quite popular. Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. 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 So, that's not so much a japa chant. Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. But you can do it like that if you want. Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. On mala, on the beats, if you like. Or you can chant a little melody. Whatever you like. Because it's a name for Vishnu. So, I recommend you testing out this mantra. It's especially good for removing negative karma, negative reaction to past activities, which bring ultimately sorrow or suffering in one form or another. So, as we've spoken about, we come into this lifetime carrying karma, or some people like to call it baggage. And we have negative karma, and we have positive karma, and we have neutral karma, or mixed. Positive karma, you know what that means? It means all kinds of good stuff happening for you. And things that kind of land in your lap, or things that work out generally the way you like it to, or better. Better than you expect. So that's good karma, positive karma. Is it preferable to the negative? I rather think so. Mixed karma is mixed karma. It's kind of, you know, your average day, right? And then negative karma is any form of suffering or difficulty that you have to undergo that you don't want to undergo. For example, supposing you get into university to study, and you're very happy that you get into university to study because this is a great opportunity for you to get a good education, perhaps to gain a degree. But the study itself is not easy, or it's difficult, or it's an austerity on some level. It's an inconvenience. It's a discipline that you have to undergo. We might argue that that's not so pleasant, but ultimately it's good karma because you're gaining the opportunity to study and to improve your life. So it's a good thing, but the study or the austerity required is, you might argue, is not always so easy. So negative karma is any kind of real suffering, there are three kinds of what they call kleshas, miseries, in the material world. Adiatmaka, Adibhautika, and Adidaivika. Adiatmaka are miseries caused by self, or within the body. If you follow a bad diet, or if you smoke cigarettes, for example, or if you drink too much Guinness or alcohol, you may have a negative, over time, you may get a negative reaction. You may have problems with that. You may get a health problem. Or you may create problems for yourself with others, for example. But all of this is miseries created by the self, one's own behavior. No one to look to but yourself. And of course, you're free to change your behavior whenever you like. Adibhautika comes from the root word bhuta, which means beings, other living beings, like mosquitoes, like those dogs who live up on the hill and bark their heads off. Like the guy who cut you off on the M50. Whoever else creates problems. Alan, you know that one, right? Whoever else might create problems for you in your life. Sometimes it's family members. Sometimes it is the employer. Sometimes it is your loved one, your spouse, your mate. Could be anybody. Sometimes it's an animal. Some people get gored by bulls. Some people get kicked by mules.
Scratched by cats.
Scratched by cats or eaten by lions.
Or humans.
Right. So Adibhautika miseries. And Adidaivika comes from Daivika, comes from the word Deva. What does that mean?
Demi-sons.
Correct. So what are those? Miseries caused by the gods. Another way to say the gods is nature or natural occurrences. Such as storms, earthquakes, tsunamis, fires, forest fires, drought, heat, famine. Right? So those are the three kinds of miseries. I'm sure you all have experienced all of them because the world is abundant with them. So you can't be in this world without suffering. It's not possible. If you want to be in a place that has no suffering, you got off at the wrong stop. Because this is not it. The spiritual world is the only place with no suffering. You could ask for a refund if you can find the ticket seller. The spiritual world is the only place where there's no suffering. If you went up to the heavenly planets is known as heavenly planets, but still in the material world, the suffering would be reduced considerably. People live very long lives. They get to enjoy themselves like nobody's business. They can eat as much as they want, not put on weight. They can have as much sex as they want and not have pregnancy if they don't want it. So all the things that we would love to do and overindulge in but cannot get away with it here, you can in the higher planetary systems. Needless to say, in the hellish worlds, the lower planetary systems, it's much worse than it is here. Much more difficult. But we can experience hell here very tangibly, very graphically. If you want to go hang out in Baghdad for a while, you'll get a big dose of hell. No doubt. If you want to go hang out in Somalia right now, you'll get a big dose of hell. You know, and wherever there's drought or famine or war or pestilence or plague or you name it. So, the only place you can get away from it all is when you decide not to come back and take birth again on the wheel of repeated birth and death. So, the Ram mantra would be of great benefit to burn off the karma, the negative karma. All right. You can chant it if you wanted something. Yes, you can. You can do that. Yeah, I mean, it's you're praying to God. I'm going to say this out loud. I probably don't need to, but I mean, there are mantras for different personalities that can be done for negative intentions toward people, for example. You would not want to chant this mantra with that in mind. You know, this is a,
when people chant for negative to somebody they don't like.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I'll give you an example. A true one. Years ago, when I was married to my first wife, and we had a young child, 2 years old, we lived in an apartment building with other young couples who had babies, and in Los Angeles. And when we would take our cars out from our parking area, we would have to back up onto the property next door to us, just onto the cement tarmac, in order to drive our cars out our own driveway. So we'd be on there for literally 5 seconds, and then out we go. Above, in a garage apartment, above a garage, there's an apartment there, and a lady lived there, an old lady. And she would curse and cuss and swear and threaten all the time, out her window, yelling. And we had little children, you know, that were subjected to this. And went on for a long time, months and months. So, you know, we were all sort of beside ourselves because this woman had lived there for 25 years. What were we going to do? What can you do? I mean, you know, she's like an old woman and she couldn't get around and she's obviously off the beam and, you know, what are you going to do? So I said, I declared it boldly that I would chant a mantra and get rid of her. That's what I told my neighbor, friends and neighbors. I said, I'll get rid of her. How are you going to do that? I said, I'm just going to chant a mantra and get rid of her. And some of the people were spiritual and they went, and some people didn't know what on earth I was talking about. And I went, you know. So I chose a Shiva mantra, because Shiva is the god of destruction, and he's the guy who wraps up creation at the end, puts an end to things. So that's Shiva's job. So now I had no evil intention to hurt the woman. It was not my intention. I didn't want her to get hurt. It wasn't vindictive. I wasn't angry. You know, there's no malice. We just wanted her out of there so our children wouldn't be, you know, she's yelling at us. We didn't care so much. Even though it's not pleasant. But you don't want your two-year-old child to hear this. And then the kids would be saying, why is she saying those things? What does that mean? You know. So I chanted this mantra 3 times a day for 2 weeks. And then I got home from work one day around 5 o'clock in the evening. I drove in, and my next door neighbor who rented the apartment in front of that lady runs out to greet me. Drew, guess what? Guess what? I said, what? She's gone. She's gone. I said, who's gone? Her. She's gone. She moved out today. The moving truck came. They loaded up all her stuff. She's gone. I said, all right. Shiva.
Who's your daddy?
Who's your daddy? So we were all very happy. Very pleased. You know, this woman had been there 25 years. We had been there a few months. So that's why you'd use a mantra like that. For that purpose. I've only used the mantra twice in my life. For very, very good reasons. That was one of them. And it's worked a charm. Worked very well. It's to be understood that if you chant a mantra, you have to gain its siddhi. S-I-D-D-H-I. Siddhi. And siddhi means the efficacy or the... what other word am I looking for here? The that the mantra will work.
Vibration.
Not
well. Mm-hmm.
The full potency. So the thing will actually become effective.
Intention.
No. The intention is what you want it to do, mm-hmm. but whether it'll do it or not, mm-hmm. you see.
So you're qualified in time.
Correct. So what you might know is some mantras have to be chanted X amount of times. We're talking about. Usually 100,000 times. 100,000. I mean, I've chanted mantras in this lifetime 100,000 times. Right now, I'm working on my major Rahu. I'm going to Rahu period. I'm chanting the Rahu mantra 18,000 times. So I've been working on that. So sometimes mantras must be chanted for thousands and thousands of repetitions before they're going to work. Right? The part we don't know is you could, because here we are all sitting here talking about mantras. Obviously, you're interested in it or you wouldn't be here. Especially those of you who come back often. So you're on the wavelength one way or another. If you're on the wavelength, you must have been on the wavelength in a previous lifetime. So that means that a lot of you would have probably been accomplished in chanting mantras from another lifetime. So, but we don't know that or we don't remember it. So that means that in this lifetime there'd be certain mantras. You know, I mean, I respect Shiva. I'll do some Shiva worship every now and then. But Shiva's not my main guy. Mainly I'm connected to Vishnu, to God, to Krishna. And, I focused on Shiva and I got a result. Exactly the result I wanted fairly quickly. So, must be some connection. So, if you already chanted certain mantra or you worshipped a certain deva or devi, female, in another lifetime, well, that's to your credit. So you may be already up and running. We were investigating Kalindi's chart one night, more from an esoteric point of view. there's a book that somebody published. In fact, I know the guy. And it's very, very esoteric stuff. It's really out there. It's the most spiritually analytical side of Vedic astrology that most people would be too much for most people. And what we discovered by examining Kalinji's chart was that she was a devotee of Ganesh in a previous lifetime. That's what the yoga or planetary combination indicated, which makes sense to her because she feels like she's on that Ganesh wavelength. I think you are too, Patrick. You said you were, you know. Fine. So different people. Yeah. So different people, you know, will on certain wavelengths. It's one thing to say a mantra, but if, and then when you say it and things happen that you want to have happen, especially when it doesn't look like they should happen, and then they do. You know, Kalindi told us the story about getting her passport when they shut down the passport office on the day we were flying to India. And she stood outside the passport office and chanted Ganesh mantras until the Indian ambassador showed up out of the blue and made sure she got her passport. And we made it to the airport on time. But she promised she'd never do that to us anymore.
So K2, if you go through K2, then what's the best mantra to?
To pacify the planets when you're going through a planetary period that may be difficult for you, there are three primary recommendations, three ways to do it. What are they? Mantra.
Meditation.
Meditation would come under the banner of mantra.
Right.
Wearing stones, gemstones, that have a vibrational affinity to the particular planet. And the third one is?
Fasting.
Okay, four ones, sorry. Fasting.
Well,
the ritual, yes, absolutely. But that's kind of thrown under mantra. But you can also fast. Fasting would be really good too. You know, each day of the week, you pick the day of the week for the certain planet.
Who's on what day?
If you're trying to pacify the sun, it's Sunday. Moon, Monday. Mars, Tuesday. Mercury, Wednesday. Jupiter, Thursday. Thursday. Friday is Venus. Saturday is Saturn. Rahu is Saturday. K2 is Tuesday. Okay. So if you would also fast in terms of doing your mantra, yes, you can do some ritual as well. And then the other thing is giving charity. You can give specific kinds of charity on those days. And that's also very, very powerful.
A funny thing happened this morning.
Should I tell? This morning I was chanting. I'm doing a minimum. I'm doing a vrata right now to Rahu, because in November my major Rahu period begins and it's going to run for 18 years. So I'm going to chant. I have all the mantras for Rahu chant, 18,000 of the mantras chanted. The mantra is this: Ardhakaya Mahaviryam Chandra Aditya Bimardhanam Singhika Garbasamutam Tamrahun Pranamamyam. It's a long one. So I said my vow was one mala a day, minimum, that I have to do one every day. It's because I knew that I could handle that for sure, because you don't want to say it and then not do it. So some days I'll do two, some days I'll do three, some days I'll do five. But I get my one done. I usually do it in the morning. So I'm sitting there and I'm doing the Ram mantra, and then I just went into a meditation. I had this really, really lovely meditation on Ra. And in my meditation, I was making an offering to Rahu of various things that I know are dear to Rahu. I was doing mentally. If you can't offer things physically, you can also offer mentally in meditation. It's just as powerful. So I was giving him all these things that I knew were dear to him, that he liked, as an offering. And the way I'm approaching the mantra is, rather than saying, you know, don't hurt me, you know, don't make my life miserable, don't be too hard on me with the karma. So that's kind of how we think, you know. I flipped over and I said, thank you for, and this I did quite a while ago, but I said, thank you for making this period so wonderful for me. Thank you for all these blessings. Thank you for helping me. And so I'm taking a different attitude, different approach to it, right? So anyway, I'm meditating like this, making these offerings to Rahu, right? The phone rings. Kalini answers the phone. She comes in. She says, it's a Maraid so-and-so. Well, I don't know who it is. So I think it's somebody who wants an appointment. So I set my mala down. I'm not finished the round. I set it down so I can pick up. And she's calling on behalf of Bank of Ireland. She's doing a survey. Well, if you know me at all, I don't have any time for this sort of thing. Never. You know, if you call up me and I hear you're selling me something, I don't even say goodbye. I just hang up. Because I lived in America. So I just click, you know. Often I'll say thank you and I'll click. That's it. You don't get a chance to badger me about it. So somehow or other I said to, yes, Maraid. She says, well, I want to ask you a 5-minute survey on behalf of Bank of Ireland. I said, okay. And even as the words came out of my mouth, I go, what the hell are you doing? You don't do these. And she says, and then at the end of it, we're going to make a gift to a charity on your behalf if you agree to participate. And I said, oh, okay. And so then she asked me the question, very nice lady, and I answered the questions, and she said, great, thank you. And it was only 5 minutes. And now we want, there's 3 charities, would you please choose one? One was for children, one was for poor, hospice, dying people. And one is for the Simon
community.
Simon community. And I said, well, I understood with the other two. I said, what's the Simon community? Oh, well, that's for the homeless. Or Rahu is the homeless. And Rahu rules the homeless. Wandering people, people who have no homes, no money, dressed in rags. That's Rahu. That's what he's in charge of. And I said, well, I want to give to the Simon charity. I want to give to the homeless. She said, very well, Mr. Lawrence. Your gift will be to the homeless. So that's what happened in the middle of this.
You said Rahu is there to protect and take care, or he is going to create, from what perspective is Rahu coming from with the homeless?
Well, each planet rules certain things in our world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like the sun rules kings and powerful people and government people and people who are wealthy and in charge, and that's the sun. So Rahu rules homeless people, derelict, you know, poverty stricken, people dressed in rags, people who would be addicted. That's who he's in charge of. So to give charity to pacify Rahu, you would need to give charity to such people. Mm-hmm. You see.
Oh, right.
So by giving charity to those people, you're pacifying Rahu.
Okay.
That's the concept. Mm-hmm. Ideally, you'd be doing it on a Saturday, but hey.
Is it Saturn, Rahu? Saturn.
Rahu behaves in some ways like Saturn. So that's why Saturday.
But he's not a planet.
Not technically a planet.
Okay.
But he's a being.
Okay.
Did you just say you're going into this phase? Did you say for the next 18 years?
Well, anybody who goes into a major Rahu period is 18 years.
Four more years.
She's so. You have 4 years left?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, for me, normally Rahu periods are very good. They're very spiritual for me. So. I know that already because I've experienced it. But that doesn't mean he won't kick my butt around the playground. He may well do that as well. So, okay. So I've talked too long. It's 10 o'clock.
Have you ever looked at the Buddha's astrological birth chart?
Yeah, I have it.
And in the book it says that he was destined to change, well, change the world in some way. Would it be very similar to
the Buddha had like four or five planets in the 10th house in Pisces, which make him a very powerful mystic and the ability to influence people in a big, big way. Yeah.
And in regard to, without going too deep into it, because I know you've talked a lot, I don't want to exhaust you anymore, this aspect of completely denying any desires and just, you know, that he self-realized, and any human, he didn't have any desires anymore.
Yes.
Because it was desires that brought us back into hell.
Yeah. Well, there's two ways to look at it. The Buddhists especially would practice desirelessness, a state of no desire whatsoever. That means, of course, no material desires or no desires connected to the senses, running around after your senses, you know, please the tongue, please the genital, and whatever else. Tongue and genital, they're high on the list though. And material desires. But another way to look at it, and from the yoga philosophy, depending, there's different viewpoints from different sources, but you can have spiritual desires. Material desires connected to the body, and the Buddha gave up all desires connected to the body. Spiritual desires are connected to the soul. To become completely desireless is very, very difficult. Very difficult. So if you become, if you shift your desire over to the spirit and desire things that are only good for your soul, or wherein you behave like a soul rather than a body, you behave in spirit rather than in matter, that generates no karma. All desires connected to the body generate karma. Spiritual desires connected to the soul generate no karma because they're done for the pleasure of God. That's the difference. And the Buddhists, the monks, and I've talked about this before, the highest level, the highest place or goal for Buddhists is nirvana. Nirvana means cessation of existence. So where do you go? Nowhere. Well, how do you go nowhere? It's hard to go nowhere. Surely you must be somewhere. There's no heaven. There's no belief in heaven. There's no belief in God. It's almost like a state of suspended animation where there's desirelessness and there's a bliss of some kind. But as I pointed out before, it seems like these Buddhists, high lamas, they keep coming back and coming back. And of course, they always say, but to serve. Okay, I accept that. Do they never want to get out of here? Mm-hmm. But if you go to nirvana, there's what my point here is, there's not much offered.
What's ahimsa?
Nonviolence. Is ahimsa. That's the essence of Buddhist philosophy, ahimsa. So, yoga philosophy is more, you you enter into a relationship with God, and then you go to that place where you go to live with God, would be, you know, similar in Christian philosophy, similar but different. You'd have a relationship with God, and you live eternally, and you'd have a life like you have
more
here.
More colorful,
more things to do, more interest, relationships. There'd be all kinds of relationships.
Yeah.
But without all the disease part, without the darkness. And that appeals to me more than hanging out in spacelessness.
So when they talk about bliss, they're not talking about Brahma, but they're not talking about Vishnu consciousness.
Yeah, they are. They're talking about a type of Brahman or spiritual consciousness. Yes. But it's not consciousness of any. And they don't believe in these higher deities. There's no belief in God in Buddhism. There is no God. So there's no. How can you talk about something that there isn't?
There is part in the book. Obviously, it's just, you know, him, Deepak, with this guy. I'd say the other guy was, I don't know his name, was mostly philosophy, possibly the idea, but. That when he became self-realized, he realized he was all alone. He was completely alone.
Yeah.
But he was able to create castles and gold and anything he wanted. He could just materialize.
Yes, all yogis can do that. Yogis can manifest anything out of nothing. Accomplished yogis. Mm-hmm. Like Jesus Christ. Same idea. Anything can be manifested. But they don't care about it. You see, when you reach that level, those things aren't important anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what do you need a bunch of gold for? I mean, why do you need the gold? Well, I need the gold so I can have a nice Indian dinner. Well, here's the Indian dinner. What do you need the gold for?
Yeah.
You know, whatever you need, it's instantly manifested.
Mm.
So what do you want to carry stuff around for? It's pure creative potency, creative energy. You're not attached to your body, so you don't need a squeeze, a boyfriend or a girlfriend. You don't really need one of those. There's lots of accomplished yogis that are married. That's acceptable. And Doug agrees. But you don't need it. You're not dependent on it. You know, when marriage is helpful to your consciousness and helps you maintain a consciousness and helps you maintain a conscious lifestyle, then it's of value. If it doesn't do that, what's the point? You know, if you want to have some kids, okay, that's fine. But you see, if you're going to get married and just generate more karma, positive, negative, and get yourself more fully entangled, because, excuse me, believe me, marriage is very entangling. Family life is unbelievably entangling. Just go ahead and spin the web. We all know what it's like. Why do you even want that if you're going to let it pull you down deeper into negative karma, action, reaction, and the wheel of samsara, repeated birth and death? You know, people think it's so wonderful. Oh, you know, family is just everything. No, it's not just everything. It's illusion. You can make it something that's conscious and enlightening and even liberating, but not 99% of the people out there. They have no idea how much family life is entangling them. I live for my family. Great. Good. Well, that means you'll be back in another body. That's what it means. I'm not saying you shouldn't take care of your family, but you're missing the point. If you really live for your family, you love your family, then help them get off the wheel of repeated birth and death. That's real service. And don't let them pull you down further into all this stuff. You know how it goes. In your family, how many people are enlightened? Well, you are. You're one. If you've got more than one enlightened person in your family, boy, you are really, really fortunate. Really fortunate. Because usually there's no enlightened people in families. And if you have one, there's one. And you're the crackpot. You're the crazy one that everybody was, well, you know, it's so and so. You know. What are you eating now? Macrobiotic? Or whatever you're into.
I was at a course on the weekend and they said, what is my ultimate goal? And I said, to self-realize. I went for the top, or my freedom. But no one knew what self-realization was. It was so new, so strange.
Well, it wasn't a spiritual course.
No, it wasn't. Oh. But I thought I thought somebody would just get that. But I kept saying it just for devil's advocate, just as, you know. But anyway, it's strange.
No.
Self-realization just is. It's just a choice.
Yeah. But it's you know, most people, they don't even know, like you say, they don't know what you're talking about.
You know what?
So that's why I'm saying, you see, a family experience. Yeah, I know we're humans and we need some
action.
Need some action. To live alone for most of us is very difficult. So I'm not criticizing anybody for being in a family experience. But it's not as wonderful as everybody tries to make it out to be. It's a big challenge. You know, from an enlightened point of view, from a higher perspective, it's more trouble than it's worth. That's why most of these sages never get married, you know, and get into all that and produce children. So, ideally, my wish for you all is that you find a wonderfully enlightened soul to be with, like I have. I'm very fortunate. This is my second marriage, and I found wonderfully enlightened souls twice. The first one, our paths diverged. So, and now I'm with Clindy, and she's a wonderfully enlightened soul. And it's way, way more exciting. Isn't it? It's just so much more exciting when you're looking at things from a higher perspective and something happens, you just look at each other. You don't have to say anything. Yeah, okay, check that out. Oh, that's interesting. You know. So much more fun.
I always said to my brothers would always say, you're just totally mad. And I say, why would you want to be normal? Everyone's normal. Yeah. Didn't want a normal person.
Yeah, she picked me. Yeah. She succeeded there. All right, so thanks very much. Let us know if you want to join us on Sunday for some Ram worship and feasting. We'll focus on a little bit more.
Thanks for doing this.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. You. You're welcome.
And most importantly, thank you for sharing your wisdom and your knowledge. And
you're most welcome. And we want to, sometimes I'm remiss, many, many lovely gifts are brought to our home. And we're very grateful for that. In particular, all kinds of nice flowers seem to arrive here regularly. And plants and...
Chocolate.
chocolate, bottles of vino, and whatever you bring, and we're very grateful for that. So, and the flowers are offered directly to the gods, by the way, as is the food. The vino, I'm not so sure about.
Really enjoy that.
No doubt.
All right.
No doubt.
Thank you. Om Tat Sat.